Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the brass ring episode. Now, there is more than one way to go for it, more than one way to put everything on the line. And our next story comes from back in the day, from Brooklyn before it was hip, when the streets of Williamsburg were rough and the mob ran Red Hook. This is the place that Lou Diaz called home.
Lou Diaz was at the wheel of his Cadillac one day while he and two of the guys he worked with, Wally and Geronimo, patrolled their territory in Harlem. Then suddenly, the radio crackled, and through the white noise, the voice that Lou heard was not the voice of a disc jockey. It was the sound of nearby police surveillance.
I mean, you could hear it distinctly that there was law enforcement personnel. It wasn't radio people. And when it came out, I just jumped. I said, "What the hell?" And I says, "What's going on here?"
Lou, Wally, and Geronimo all worked for Nicky Barnes, one of the biggest drug dealers in New York City. If the police had been watching them all day, Lou knew that they might have a big problem.
So I drove the car immediately. I drove the car to the first place that I could hide it, and it was down a back alley. I came down a back alley with the car. I said, "You guys better be straight here. Something's going on here." And I parked the car immediately, and I drew my 9mm, and I turned around, and I pointed it at Wally and Geronimo, who was right next to me. I said, "Get out of the car, now." And I says, "Get up against the car." And now they're going crazy. "Louis, what's wrong? Louis, for Christ's sake, what's wrong?" He says, "We heard it. It's just that happens sometimes. I mean, there's cops in the area." Of course, you know, now Wally's going nuts. He says, "Louis, no, please. You gotta understand, I'm not with anybody. I'm with you. So finally, I allowed them to settle me down, put my 9mm back, and I patted them down just in case they, you know, I did the whole search, you know, the whole body search to see if they had a wire on them. We all got back in the car and went about our business.
But it turns out that the police were on to them. Not long after, everyone Lou worked with was picked up as part of a massive takedown of Nicky Barnes' drug distribution network. Lou was in the police station when he ran across Wally right after the police interrogated him. Wally wanted to make sure Lou knew he'd never give up anything to the man.
I'll never forget this. Wally looked up at me and he says, "Louis, don't worry. I didn't say a thing. And I looked at Wally. I tell you, I got glassy-eyed, I got to tell you, because sometimes you get close to these people, and Wally was not a bad guy. He really wasn't a bad guy. He was a funny character. I says, "Wally, I hate to tell you," he says, "but I am the man."
Lou was an undercover cop. He worked for the NYPD, then for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and finally for the DEA in New York City during the heyday of cocaine and heroin. Playing a gangster, Lou penetrated networks easily and rose in the ranks quickly. He knew how to play this part so well because these were the guys he grew up with.
You know, I knew how these guys thought. I knew the moves. Growing up in the neighborhood, knowing mob guys in the neighborhood, knowing how they acted, how they reacted, how they looked, how they walked. I had all these things to work with. So I felt very comfortable in that environment. Matter of fact, I felt more comfortable in that environment than I did working with my fellow feds, who I loved and adored, or with the police for that matter. Because to some degree, I'm not a big fan of cops, at least not the bad ones. You know, and there's a lot of cops, even feds, they use their shield and their gun as an extension of their own prejudice. I hate that with a passion. I hate it. I mean, it's worse than being a crook. At least a crook says he's a crook. He is a crook. A criminal has more respect from me because he stands for what he is. Nothing more, nothing less than a crook.
Lou grew up in Red Hook, Brooklyn, back when it was run by the mob and everyone identified with the country their parents immigrated from.
These were tough men, you know, working hard for a living, blue-collar workers, truck drivers, you know, merchant marine, longshoremen, the backbone of America, you know. And my father, he was my king. He was my role model. He was my everything. When we got along well, it was beautiful for me. But
he never hugged or kissed me. Never told me I love you.
I don't want to sound like whimpering here. But as much as I love my father, he never hugged or kissed me. And everything had to be done like a man. Even sweeping, you had to sweep like a man. You know, there was a certain way you sweep, you know, a certain way you moved, a certain
way. What does that mean? How do you sweep like a man?
I'd have to show you. You sweep aggressively. He was big on me being a man and me doing the right thing because the neighborhood was pretty tough. I remember my first being at age 5 over nonsense. I think I woke him up and he got up and just beat the piss out of me, man. And you know how you get that cry when you can't breathe? I'll never forget that. I couldn't catch my breath. I was crying so much and my mother would jump in his face and be savage, stop, you know? And then after he'd stop, he'd go to bed. Like he had like this adrenaline surge and then it just went away and he just left him blank. That was the first time I gotta say my innocence was taken from me then. And then after that, it was just a series of other beatings for many different things, but it was always over some bullshit thing, you know? The biggest one was where I was walking down the hallway and there was a hat on the floor and I missed it because it was dark. I just stepped over it unwittingly. And my father looks down at it and he goes, "Mister, you realize what you did?" I said, "No, what'd I do?" Because I used to answer him back sometimes. Not answering back like, you know, very aggressively, but kind of like a Weisenheimer a little bit, you know? And he hated that. First thing I know, he just gets up and just, boom, hits me with a right hand, knocks me against the wall, and just commenced to beat the out of me. And it got so where I could hear the thuds to my face, the knuckles crashing on my face. And the first time in my life, I felt my brain actually rock in my head. I said, "This ain't normal," you know, but it actually rocked in my head. We'll find out later, that's what a fighter goes through when he gets hit good, you know? That's what made me a good fighter, because I was used to it. I knew what it was. It was a surprise when I got hit like that. I was just about to pass out, and then my grandmother and mother jumped on him. And then my grandmother fell down. He got worse. And then, finally it stopped. Finally it stopped. They were able to calm him down. But I was battered and beaten, and I never forgot that for the rest of my life. But you know, I wasn't the only guy getting beat. That's just the way it was in the neighborhood, except my father happened to be stronger than most of the fathers in the neighborhood. As a result of that, I was one tough son of a bitch. But in a good way. There was nobody gonna with me or beat me like my father. Nobody. And nobody ever was gonna hit me like that. So I was the number one boy in the neighborhood.
That's when Joe Gallo, a local Sicilian mob boss, took notice.
And I was close to Gallo growing up as a kid because they loved me. They used to grip me in the headlock, "Come here, kid, you know, give me noogies," you know. And as a matter of fact, when I came out of the service, they wanted me to turn pro.
Why did you decide not to?
Because my father said no. That's a good enough reason.
Next best thing was become a cop.
Yeah.
I wanted to show my peers, if I was to become a cop, that you didn't have to be a bully. You know, that your job was to protect the people. Your job was to serve the people.
So Lou signed up with all his good intentions, but his dad still was skeptical.
He had a suspicious feeling about law enforcement in general. Kind of felt they were fascist in nature because of how they treated people and their mindset. So he was concerned about my falling into that bag with these people.
Lou was an obvious pick for going undercover in neighborhoods like the one he grew up in. And right away, he showed that he had a knack for fitting in with a rough crowd.
I just had a gift of being able to be in the moment and to seize the moment and react to the moment accordingly and appropriately.
Lou spent all his time hustling out on the streets. He started small by selling untaxed cigarettes to sniff out the criminals, and then he'd work his way up to the big guys. Soon, he'd be handing off duffel bags of cocaine in empty parking lots. He developed tricks for how to get a wire, passed a pat-down, and made sure everyone always knew he was armed to the hilt. And at the same time, back at the office, his fellow officers respected him for taking big risks with big payoffs. Didn't take long for Lou to move up and start working with the feds. When he wasn't undercover, Lou was a loving father and husband. He was friendly and generous and easy to be around. Undercover, though, Lou wasn't just adaptive, he was fierce. He'd be the first to pull his gun if you looked at him the wrong way.
He's saying that there were times when you could tell that you were in some ways like your father.
Oh, sure.
I guess, did that ever bother you, especially as far as like the temper goes?
No, because there was a lot of things like my father that I wanted to be like. He made me a warrior, and a good warrior, a true warrior, a noble warrior, and I was very proud of that. I adored him. He was my idol. He was my idol. However, the temper, I think that's genetic. And I worked upon that temper of mine. I worked upon it because I had these buttons, these big buttons. You know, push this button and watch Louis dance. Push this button and watch Louis fight.
When he could control it, when he could channel it, that temper could actually be useful undercover. But sometimes it would bleed into his personal life.
My brother was an epileptic since birth. And my kid brother, Alfonso, he was a gifted athlete. Kid was strong as a bull. The only thing, he would get these seizures. I mean, he would get up to 70 attacks a day, this kid. So on this particular day, now that we're older, he's staying home, he's being protected and taken care of by my mother and father. And he had a lot of attacks that day. My brother was coming in, my brother Rigo was coming in from London with his family. So I was gonna go and pick him up at the airport. I took Alfonso with me. So I put the, you know, seatbelt on him and we took off. We went down a throughway and it was coming down. It was raining cats and dogs. I mean, I couldn't even see through the windshield, okay? And he starts to catch a fit, epileptic fit. And he starts tearing at me, you know, and I'm trying to get him away from me. But he had enough reach to get at the wheel, the steering wheel. So he's grabbing at the wheel. And here I am, you know, driving on the freeway, at least 70 miles an hour. So I wanted to get out of that lane and go over, and I couldn't. I had to stick, I couldn't see. And he kept grabbing at the wheel and I kept smacking him back. I had my left hand on the wheel, I reached for my gun. I took it out and I was about to put it to his head. And I was just visualizing me pulling the trigger and just saying, you know what, it's over. My family don't have to worry about him anymore. They can live their lives and he's out of his misery. And in that instant, he stopped. He says, Lou, where am I? What's going on? Boy, I'm telling you, I cried like a baby. I cried like a baby. He says, why are you crying, Lou? I says, because I'm just so happy all the brothers are going to get together now. And that was that.
But Lou had an uncanny ability to draw from even the most painful experiences from his life to help him do better police work.
I carry around a vial of vitamins, white vitamins, so that I don't have to use drugs with people. Because when they offer me drugs, I say, no. I got enough drugs that I use. What are you using that for? What is that? I say, it's phenobarbital, because I'm an epileptic. I get seizures, so I can't be dealing with that.
Lou's fake epilepsy turned out to be particularly handy when Lou had to ID a local mobster to start a case file on him. At the time, everyone just knew him as Little Man.
So Little Man knew I was an epileptic because I showed him that and I told him that. I have to ID him, right? So one of the ways I ID'd him was I'm driving. I purposely lose control of the car. I go over a couple of garbage pails. I go toward a fence, stop, screech. And now he's all over the place. God, going on? Holy, let me drive. God, what's the matter? You got another seizure? Take your pill. And I says, no, I'll be okay. Let me just sit down and relax here a little bit. I says, let you drive. I don't even know if you got a license. He says, I got a license. Here. And he shows it to me. And I had a photographic memory at that time. So, man, I just go, and I had that license right in my head.
By the time the Nicky Barnes case came up, the one where they caught Wally, Lou had been working undercover for almost 20 years. And when they took Nicky down, some people say that the heroin deaths in New York City were cut down to a quarter of what they were before. It was a crowning achievement of Lou's career.
It was fulfilling in that I got over getting these bad guys. Besides taking down these organizations, one of the things for me was the fact that I could get over on these guys. And that was a great reward, that I was able to win, if you will. But beyond that, it was the attention that I got from my fellow agents, if you will, the applause that I received from, you know, friends and people who knew me, who knew about the case. Reader's Digest did an interview on me, and it came out in the Reader's Digest.
Did your dad read that article?
Yes, he did. But I didn't know about it until maybe a year or so later. But he was, for some reason, short on giving me my proper accolades, if you will. So I sought it elsewhere, and the job gave me an important and significant platform for me to get that recognition.
After more than 30 years undercover, Lou finally stepped down. His walls were covered in awards and articles written about his work, but without the job, Lou felt unmoored. Then in 2005, Lou got a call. His father's heart was failing. Now living in California, he flew home to join his brothers at his father's bedside. When he got there, his father lay only half conscious.
And near the end there, I saw my father passing away. I saw my whole world crashing. And I still wasn't sure of how he really felt about me.
Lou asked his brothers if he could have a moment alone, and once they were gone, Lou just stood there looking at his father's quiet face. He didn't think he'd ever hear his father's voice again when Lou heard his father murmur something.
On his deathbed, my father mentioned two names. He mentioned mine and my mother's.
My father never really said, "I love you, son," and I guess, like anybody else, I missed hearing that. But when he mentioned my name and his dying moments, I just lost it. And I laid down with him in bed, and I thanked him, and I told him how much I loved him. And not long after that, he passed away.
I knew for sure he loved me. You know? Yeah. Damn. And that's that.
Thanks so much to Lou Diaz for sharing that story. Lou's had a long and illustrious career as an undercover cop and federal agent. We just couldn't fit it all in this one story. If you want to hear more of his tales, check out his book, Dancing with the Devil, Confessions of an Undercover Agent. You'll find a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score for that piece was composed by Renzo Gorio, and the story was produced by Julia DeWitt.